Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
When things just seem kind of unbounded and super challenging and hard to really make progress on, I always find that you want to look for the constraints. And those actually, to me, well, initially some of them felt very frustrating. They kind of feel like a warm, like a nice balm, like something that's really helpful in terms of like having a North Star. Like you find your horizon, there's a constraint. It's like if it actually isn't a movable thing, either it's something that's imposed by the business, something that's imposed by the technology. And then from there, you have an anchor, something that's a good cornerstone that you're able to then orient from.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, my friend?
Well, this is not a shameless plug. I just have to say I'm running because I am finding four developers for two clients of ours. So I'm just running like crazy. All good, all promising. But yeah, it's crazy. It's all good, all nice. I love this job. I like it. I love it.
Every day is a little bit intense. But you know, I think one of the great things about working on this podcast together is it gives us a chance to step back from that, to think about things a little bit in a bigger context, to talk with other people as well. And we had a really interesting conversation today with an old friend of ours, Dave Hafner, who talked with us about his journey from being a software tester to a software developer. What did you think about this conversation?
Well, Dave is such a fascinating person. He is a very deep software developer. So I think this conversation was more philosophical than anything else. I met Dave. I mean, you brought him to Costa Rica 12 years ago, I think. And I can see his journey, very good conversations about why the work we do matters, why having a good mental structure is good for your work, but for your health and for your life. I really like this episode because of that.
Yeah, I agree. Dave is a really interesting and philosophical person. It really shows in how he cares about the craft of what he's doing. And I think that's something that shines through this conversation for me, with just how much he cares about that craft of his work, whether it's software testing or development or everything that kind of goes in between and around those. And I particularly enjoyed the conversation too around, he threw out some terms that I like that I'm going to try and remember myself around. You talk about like trying to solve difficult problems, looking at the constraints of those as your North Star or your anchor and things that you can kind of hold on to as you work through this difficult problem. I enjoyed that part of the conversation in particular. So yeah, get ready for a really interesting conversation with Dave about how he made that transition from being a software to developer. So let's get to our interview with Dave Hafner. Joining us now is Dave Hafner. Dave, you and I first met when we were both master's students at the University of Virginia. We studied management and information technology at the UVA McIntyre School of Commerce. We overlapped there. And later on, you met up with David and I in Costa Rica and did some test automation training to one of our first development teams in our company there. It's really great to see you again. Thanks for joining David and I today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm happy to see you again. This is fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It has been, yeah. We were reminiscing about roadside cafes that we visited in Costa Rica back on that trip. But today we're going to talk a little bit more about kind of your career, your transition from a QA analyst, then a consultant around test automation practices, and now as a software developer working now in a company with a lot of large legacy applications, I know, which I think is always interesting and challenging for our listeners. So we're going to leave the details of your employer out of the conversation today, but we do want to talk about kind of the journey that you've made from QA analyst to developer, the lessons you've learned along the way. So let's kind of start with that, Dave. How did you make that transition from QA analyst to a software developer?
Well, I guess, as they say, like a little bit at first and then all of a sudden all at once. So a lot of people who followed my work know me primarily for doing stuff in software testing. But I think of more in terms of my transition into as a software developer that I kind of wanted two things. I'm more of like this, I guess, renaissance aspiring renaissance man. Like there's things that I want to keep doing. And there was a point in my life where I wasn't even involved in software at all. Before that, I was I have a undergraduate degree in network engineering. And ironically, I took an intro to programming course in university, and I failed it the first time I took it. So I, you know, for me to be a software developer full time is kind of a laughable thing if you were to kind of hold those two up and compare them. So there's like the aspiring renaissance. And then there's just, as I was doing the software testing, I kind of realized that really I was at that point in my life, I was a software developer trapped in a QA's body. It's kind of what it felt like. And so I, through the course of the things that I was doing in terms of content creation, consulting, and all these things, I was building my own infrastructure to support my business. And because there were certain things I was doing that the commercial off-the-shelf tools that were available as a commodity were actually, I was challenging some of their assumptions. And so I had to kind of build these filler apps that would like make my MailChimp stuff for email campaigns work just how I wanted it. And later tools caught up and now things are way easier in turnkey. And I later at some point switched and I was able to delete all these apps and remove that kind of code. But I was building these custom web apps and these custom just little server apps that would just receive requests and then send payloads that would do just the right thing and make things work how I wanted. So I, over the course of it, I realized I was more interested in that than I was the actual consulting and the actual content creation and all of those things. And but there was this weird problem, this kind of chicken and egg situation where I'd never been a software developer as an employee. And people knew me as this person who did QA. So it's like I could go be a QA engineer somewhere, but it was a lot harder to kind of walk in the front door into a developer position. And so at the same time, though, there was this interesting thing where I was pretty good friends with these couple of Israelis who helped co-found a startup. And I basically said, hey, would you ever be interested in, I don't know, having me join your R&D team and relocate my family to Israel? And I was very shocked that such an outrageous question was responded with a yes. And so the way that it worked basically was I was able to parlay my work in browser automation and then open source into a position working as a full-time open source software developer for the work that my employer was doing for this one particular project. And so I was kind of, it was like a twofold thing. I was meant to help do bug fixes, implement feature requests, and help answer questions, fill in missing content, help educate the community, and help evangelize things that we were trying to work on. And so there was a ton of work, and I did that as part of the relocation to Israel. There was another colleague who was, so there's one other developer who was in Israel who was doing that full time as well. So I was immediately working with him, and we just were heads down, just shipping stuff constantly. And it was a huge growth period in terms of just things that I learned, the challenges of taking on such a monster application that had a huge user base. It, you know, an open source project with like 100,000 users or more, and had a long history that dates all the way back to like 2005. And it's just a complex set of challenges because it was actually a browser extension that challenged a lot of security constraints that are inherent in browser extensions. So that was interesting. And then later, we dissolved that team, and I was dumped into a different team, and it was in the same programming language. So it was kind of like a, hey, we're not doing this thing anymore, but we need you over here. And so I joined a team that was focused primarily on like things that relate to the product of how my employer makes money. And I've been there pretty much ever since, minus, you know, a sabbatical in between.
That's a great developer origin story of basically having to hack together the things that you needed to do a different job and realizing along the way that that's the fun part of being a developer, right?
Yeah.
I love it. Did you, what changed about your mindset as you sort of made that transition bit by bit and then all at once, as you said, from QA and trainer, and in particular, I think it's also interesting that you were in trainer consultant mode for a number of years and then going into a software developer in the trenches implementer mode.
I honestly, I'm not sure how much of my perspective had changed. I mean, along the way, before I had become a developer, I was really trying to focus on the craft of software. And I realized the only way that I would really level up to where I wanted to be was to work with other people. And I've heard people describe it as it's like being in a jazz band and you want to be the worst person in the jazz band because you'll constantly learn from them. And instead of me just being some dude who's just like hacking together stuff and not knowing any better, the best thing I had was to turn to books and podcast interviews and things like that. So it's like reading up on extreme programming and then getting, you know, really into, you know, Kent Beck's work and Martin Fowler's work. And then realizing there's these other books that people reference, but they're for programming languages that I wasn't super familiar with. But nonetheless, there was still interesting things to learn. So like the Gang of Four book and other things like it. Martin Fowler's book on working effectively with legacy code. And the list goes on. So it's like I had downloaded all that stuff into my brain over the time. And by the time I then was consulting, that was like the thing I was really consuming, because I would get brought into large enterprise situations where there would be massive amounts of developer teams and they all are trying to implement QA automation in a consistent way across all of their organization, but they run into issues and are looking for ways to improve. And I'm constantly reviewing test code, you know, for better or worse. You know, some people might not treat that as like real quote unquote code, but there's a lot of the lessons that are learned from the things that I read that, let's see, a fair number are applicable, and a lot of challenges companies face actually are more process oriented instead of technology oriented. There's good times to abstract and there's bad. There's my favorite, I say my least favorite kind of abstraction, which is over abstraction, which I see a lot. And so it's like all of these things. So I had this mindset when I then went to go work as a software developer, where there's like the things that were kind of like sacrosanct, like ideals, and then there's reality. And so for me, it was trying to reconcile where's that middle ground, because there's the things you always think, you know, oh, you're supposed to do it this way, but then you're like, oh, but then there are constraints. And then for me, I guess the thing that I really embraced over time was that when things just seem kind of unbounded and super challenging and hard to really make progress on, I always find that you want to look for the constraints, and those actually, to me, well, initially some of them felt very frustrating. They kind of feel like a warm, like a nice balm, like something that's really helpful in terms of like having a North Star. Like you find your horizon. There's a constraint. It's like if it actually is an immovable thing. Either it's something that's imposed by the business, something that's imposed by the technology. And then from there, you have an anchor, something that's a good cornerstone that you're able to then orient from. And for me, that's like the backdrop of everything I brought in with this perspective of all these learnings, plus like the reconciliation usually comes down to, you know, acknowledging I work in kind of a ludicrous version of software development is what it feels like. I mean, I'm constantly surprised every week. Yeah, and I feel like I've seen everything, and then I'm constantly challenged by what I see in my job in terms of how people use the software that we have, and like, and the list goes on. And so for me, it's always, okay, but what's the constraint? And then also the other one is what's changed. Like usually something breaks and you don't understand why. And there's usually at least a half dozen different things in the tech stack that I work in that could cause that to happen. So it's, you know, for me, it's coming back to these, like, what are these simple fundamentals? Like, it's really nice, these great ideas that these practitioners who wrote these things down talk about. And then they're able to typically summarize it into something nice. And at the time, with the problems they were working on and the technologies they were using, these are great applicable things. And then you end up in your circumstance and it might not be the same. So for me, I'm always like trying to distill it down to something that's more at like an atomic level. And it's like, what's changed and what are the constraints? And then from there, work my way back up, try to find the in-between between like, that's what the book said, and then this is what reality is showing me. Okay, but here is gravity. Here is gravity in this situation. Okay, which way is up? Okay, let's work up from there.
You mentioned something that I found very fascinating, the fact that you always wanted to be an aspiring Renaissance man. And as such, I will imagine that you're always finding the first principles of everything. I guess. I mean, what is the common principle among all these different disciplines, or what is the first principle that all these technologies and all the tendencies in the world are converging to? Have you detected that? Have you observed that?
I still work largely in the browser mobile automation space, which is where I came from, but I work basically building developer tools for that space. And for me, it's about the fundamental first principles about how those technologies work. And so when there is a problem and it's something pretty obscure, like some weird configuration or some issue with some service provider, I'm able to like step back and understand like, okay, this is what's happening there. So I should be able to tease out just enough to build the smallest reproducer that I can. And for me, after spending so much time is in QA, I'm the first person to say this should not be an end-to-end test. Like, we need to find the best way to we need to understand what's happening at a root level. And the best test to me is the kind where you can tease it out and it's like a very simple unit test that demonstrates the failure in the logic, or some middle ground being a nice integration test, maybe with some sophisticated setup, but not needing to rely on such a huge round trip and all of these different moving parts. So for me, it's always trying to understand what's the thing that's actually happening at the lowest level, pulling it out and putting it into something that ideally is an automated test, and something that, that's not esoteric or tacit knowledge that you have to remember and then or share with people. Because there's a lot of that in the domain that I work in. Just not even just the fact that it's in browser automation, mobile automation. It's just like in the code that we work in, there's just a lot of things that we inherited, a lot of domain knowledge that just isn't widely distributed. So, and a lot of it is doing things that are very custom. It's not like doing front-end development where it's a known thing and people largely follow the same practices. No, we're building like custom, custom local servers that are running on people's machines to connect their test code to a service provider and do all of these fascinating things with the applications that they're testing. And it's so in that, it's the idea of legacy to me is not about like there are no tests. It's that there are tests, but maybe there's a lot more that you need to know, or the ability to actually set up the environment correctly so that you could test them appropriately is also difficult.
Right. In fact, I mean, there are cases where you find, or where you are, I don't know if that happened to you, that you receive a test suite, but you realize that the tests are not actually valuable. I mean, the value that provide each test maybe is not that high.
Yeah.
That happens, right? I mean, it is like some developers can confused that the idea that you have to create automated tests that actually provides value, that actually tests the actual value of the application, not necessarily the coverage per se.
Exactly. Yeah. And I learned over time that like tests look very differently depending on when you write them. Like for me, it was like, if I can do more of a TDD approach to building or debugging of a feature, the test ends up looking very different than me writing a feat, like writing something and then trying to add a test after the fact. And then, and the feeling that maybe the coverage is not quite the same. It's different depending on if it's something new that I'm writing versus something existing. Like for me, it's always, this is something I always go back to, and it's not something I can do every time, but working in a legacy application, I found that the way that progress tends to happen is cleaning up each piece as you go and making it nicer every time. So like, oh, this thing is broken. Let me figure out what's broken. Oh, it's in this monster function. Let me see if I can pull this into a pure function and actually test it using like a very controlled set of objects without any sort of state mutation.
Right.
And then put it, and then like just send the call from this monster function, but I'm testing this thing over here. Okay, now that's cleanly abstracted. Then the next time I have to come back to this function, I'll clean up the next thing. And then over time, this whole thing will actually be nice and clean. What I realize over time is like, there are just some expensive end-to-end tests that need to happen due to architectural constraints. And then over time, maybe we can remediate that. And that's what we've seen. Like we've actually gone through a huge phase shift where we're able to re-architect the code that we use so that it can be used by in a way that's beneficial to every permutation. So I work primarily in SDKs. So we're the plumbing that connects customers to our service. And it used to be that we would actually implement a fix in one language and for one framework, and then there would be the same bug would pop up for another language in another framework, and we'd have to just basically cargo, copy, paste, re-implement. And now what we did is we said, no, we'll just fix all of the issues that we can find for this one language, and then we'll just wrap it in a nice network layer, and then have a protocol that all of these other languages and frameworks will then speak to our server, and then everybody wins. And then we fix a bug once, then it should raise the quality of everybody's everything. And so that's like a long time in the making, and actually getting it right so that it works for all of these different use cases has taken a long time, but we're now just getting to that point. And I'm learning that even though that this architecture is kind of obvious and makes sense and works really well, there's a lot of challenges that are inherent to getting it to that last mile. Like there's all these things like platform specific issues, language specific issues, dependency issues. Actually do it, like we have these tests that verify behavior, but then if you package it up and ship it, there's potentially a dependency issue that could happen in certain languages, and so that we did that weren't caught in automated testing. So it's just understanding the scope of like the things so for me, like this is me like having my assumptions challenged even again. It's like, oh, I thought we solved the problems and now new problems come up, but then it's like there's in my head the saying goes like it has to get better before it gets has to get worse before it gets better, and that's kind of what it feels like right now. But ultimately knowing that the process is to constantly improve the test automation, the coverage, and try to do it at the lowest possible level so that and remove as much knowledge that needs to be had by everybody, and then ideally start removing people from the pipeline so that we could say we have a new fix in core for this nice server, and I just want to hit a button, have it shipped to every language, like, and actually have tests run that verify everything everywhere, and is scalable. Like that to me is the end goal. And right now, it's just trying to there's like the technical constraints, and then there's the people constraints, the existing organization, trying to navigate that. And there's not that I live in like a largely political organization, but there is existing, I don't even want to call it scar tissue. It's like, there's not even this negative thing. It's just, there's existing paradigms that exist and we're trying to influence them to something that's more streamlined. And I think that everybody kind of, they understand it. They understand that that's where we want to be. And that they even see the value in it. It's just, you know, when you have the pressures of being in a high paced startup environment and the demands of the business, and then you have existing legacy code, and then all of the domain challenges, it's like making progress always feels like three steps forward, two steps back. So you're like, we're making a little progress, but it's never as dramatic as we thought. We're like, oh, we did it. Oh, wait, nope. Okay. We made a little progress. Okay. And then we keep doing it. So like, it feels like a lot of waste going into that. And over time, I'm hoping that it's, you know, becomes two steps forward, one step back. And then maybe it's just one step forward. And then we start making more progress.
I have one more question, because you also mentioned something very interesting to me. You mentioned craftsmanship. And I mean, the best way to find your passion is when you commit yourself to be a craftsman. I mean, to do the craft. I mean, to really devote yourself to do it. I mean, to feel in your hands how things are taking shape. and get into the zone and build it and spend time and just rejoice in discovering the shape of the thing that you are building. Now, I think you are currently working remotely, right?
I am. I was working in the office and then moved back at some point a couple years ago.
Okay. My question is, as time passes, there are more and more distractions for every human. and software developers are also humans that are facing these distractions. How do you deal being a remote person to with the distractions so you can focus yourself on the craftsmanship of building software?
It's an interesting question. So as far as distractions of that are within my physical space, it's, you know, now that I have two young children and when they're not in care, it's challenging. And when they are in care, it's not so hard. And then otherwise, it's putting my phone on Do Not Disturb. Being not obsessed about checking, you know, Slack or Trello or email. It's just, you know, I have a thing that, you know, typically it's like, this is the most important thing that needs to be done unless someone tells me otherwise. And then I focus on that and take it as far as I can. But there are times it is challenging if there's five things that they're all urgent, then, you know, it's, it can be more difficult because then you carry the stress of it with you. And it's harder to focus, and there are times where it's easy to lose your cool when you have this expectation of this. Last time I ran these set of tests, it worked just fine, and then you run it again, and you're like, nothing changed in our code, but yet, you know, I'm getting the most bizarre test errors. Like, this is what happened to me earlier today, and I'm like, well, okay, and then you have to just like, maybe now is a good time for a coffee break. And I guess the other side is just good amount of coffee and make sure it's good coffee. And then everything kind of sorts itself out.
Right.
Everything sorts itself out with good coffee, right?
You know, I discovered something. I mean, the point of view that email, the problem with email is that all the emails that you receive are about people wanting a piece of your attention. It's not about you. It's about what others want about you. And yeah. When I started seeing things like that, then I don't see as important. I mean, I just see the email with that. I mean, with understanding that if I am paying attention, and if I am paying attention to email, I'm not paying attention to myself. And that changed my mind completely. It is not that I don't answer timely. Is that I'm going to focus myself on myself in the things I have to do first.
Yeah, and I think that I've been fortunate that over time, email has not become the primary means of communicating with the people I care about. And then the other thing is, not to sound like, you know, someone that. You know, is mightier than thou, but like a while back, when I took this sabbatical away from work, I was kind of like really burnt out. So I didn't disable my social media. I deleted them. I backed them up because maybe there's photos and stuff I cared about. And then I straight up deleted everything and did a hard reset. And so the distractions that people talk about, it's more like, you know, whether or not I end up just reading, you know, news articles or something more, or watching YouTube. It's like stuff like that. It's not like me going on Twitter and getting obsessed with doom scrolling. Right. And for better or worse, because then the conversations and interactions I have are with like the people who I talk to on the phone on a regular basis or who I see on a daily basis in person. And so like the people I used to see, like, oh, my cousin had a kid. It's like, I don't know. I'm like, I know my, you know, it's like, I don't have those updates like I used to. And then my wife followed suit, so I'm not even getting updates like vicariously through her. So we're a household that's like divorced from like modern times a little bit. Like we're not on social media, and so we go to like dinner parties with family, and they say like, "Oh my gosh, did you see blah 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 on Facebook?" I'm like, "No," and I'm like, "It feels good to say that with a hearty no." So yeah.
Well, that's a whole different podcast topic, perhaps, but a really powerful one of separating our healthy ways to separate ourselves from reality in order to focus on the things in our professional life, in our craftsmanship, as David said, that bring us joy. Dave, I want to wrap up by asking, I think you have a very holistic view of technology and software development, I think, in the sense that having come from being a QA analyst to a developer and for you, that not being a big mental shift, as you said, really kind of, you know, it was the same sort of ideals of craftsmanship throughout, I think, is really the way that like agile software development should be done, right? We're not really about certain job titles, even though most companies still employ them and even organize their teams around it. So I think that's wonderful, you having that vision. If you are talking to someone else who wants to make that same sort of journey from QA into software development, or from QA into just a more holistic, all-encompassing role in software development, let's say, what advice would you give them to go down that path?
Wow. So I'll just speak from my own experience, what I looked for and what was interesting to me. And you know, people can choose to maybe select if that's helpful for them or not. But what I thought made the most sense, and what feels like intuitively feels correct, and even after having made this decision, I had left my employer to just focus on family, my wife going back to work, and then I decided to rejoin the same employer. I looked, I was like assessing, where do I want to go? What do I want to do? And it was clear to me that like I existentially reviewed like what's important to me and what, and I'd sleep on it. And then I'd reassess, and I'd try to really try to make sure it's not just a conceptual thing I'm trying to, it's like not, can't logic my way through it. I have to make sure I wake up and I feel good about my decision. And for me, what I came back to was that it's not just like the problems you're working on or the technology stack. I mean, for some people, maybe that's important. It's not about the money. Like largely historically, decisions I've made specifically for money as the primary motivator have turned out to be mistakes. So for me, it was about the people that I worked with, and like that you know, people talk about culture, but for me, it's like who are the people you'd get to work with? Do you feel like there are people who, you know, maybe would take you under their wing, would challenge you, where you feel like you can kind of show up and be your whole self, and feel like you're you know, every week you're learning something, you're becoming better, and you know, things can be hard, but that's kind of where the growth happens. And so for me, it was important to go work at this company initially, because from the outside, I thought that actually was, you know, what the perception I had of what the team was that, based, largely on, I mean, the quality of the product that they shipped and the people that I knew who started that company. And then, you know, having been in that company, both in Israel and remotely, I came to the same conclusion and realized that the same logic I used to initially make that decision way back when was applicable and still relevant. And so for me, that's kind of my North Star. It's important, most important to me. It's like, it's who I spend time with and who I'm working with. And then from there, everything else kind of flows. It's like, okay, we work on a cool thing. Everyone's rallied around this cause. Is this, and it's like, you know, there's obvious like pre-qualifiers. It's like, I don't want to work for a company that does harm. And things like that you check that, but those are like kind of, you focus on the right people implicitly, those things kind of take care of themselves. And if it's awesome people that you want to work with, odds are they're probably getting like, they're probably working in a great spot and getting paid pretty well. And like, so it's like, if you can actually get in where there are people who like, man, I really want to hang out with those people. Like that's who I want to spend my time with. Then I feel like everything just kind of sorts itself out. And I feel like I found that. I found my tribe.
Awesome. I love it. David, any final thoughts on your part?
No, I have a takeaway, I think. My takeaway is that um, is never stop learning, never stop growing. I mean, something that I really loved about being a software developer is that it is a self-discovery process in so many respects. And so the only way that you can grow as a software developer is if you make a deep dive into yourself and to understand how to grow and what are the things that makes you passionate. I am very happy to see Dave again after 10 years and see his growth as a software developer, as a professional, as a father. I didn't know he was a father up until presently, so it is just fantastic. So I like that. I mean, I think that the takeaway for me today is growth. That I love that very much.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed talking with you and seeing you again. Let's do it again.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to do it.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.